But we should make some progress on the spy today before getting distracted again. Each of the three light weavers was suspicious in their own way, Beryl most so currently. That said, Ishna had worked with actual thieves in the past, and she was the only agent who had come to Shallan instead of needing to be recruited. Ishna had wiggled her way into being Shallan's right-hand woman, and was the most skilled member of her unseen court. The most damning fact was Ishna's previous fascination with the Ghostbloods. Thinking of her as a traitor made Shallan's insides squirm, but she forced herself to confront the problem, Radiant cheering her on. Shallan joined Ishna as the two Peakspren returned to their work. "You look overwhelmed," Shallan noted to Ishna. "Are you well?" "I've seen into this place, Brightness." Ishna closed her notebook and looked across the rolling beads. "When I soul cast, it's there. I see the souls of objects, hear their thoughts. I've dreamed of this world, but being here is different. Do you ever feel something below in the ocean?" "Yes," Shallan admitted. She leaned against the railing. Ishna mimicked her posture. "Now," Vale said, "try steering the conversation in a way that implies you know something secret, something she should be ashamed about." Steering conversations was fortunately comfortable for Shallan. She was good with words, better than Vale in many cases. "There are currents to this world, Ishna," Shallan said. "They move unseen. They can tow you under suddenly, abruptly, when you thought you were swimming along perfectly safe."
I'm not sure what you mean by that, Brightness."
"I think you do." Ishna immediately glanced away. "Aha," Vale thought. "We're on to something already."
"Too easy," Radiant thought. "Don't judge so quickly."
"We all lie, Ishna," Shallan continued. "Especially to ourselves. It's part of what makes us light weavers. The purpose of the ideals, however, is to make us learn to live for truth. We have to be something better, become something better, to be worthy of our spren." Ishna didn't respond, instead staring at the ocean beads passing beneath.
"Give it time," Vale suggested. "Don't be in a rush to fill the silence."
Shallan obeyed, and the silence quickly became uncomfortable. She could see Ishna shifting, not meeting her eyes. Yes, she felt guilty about something. "Now, push."
"Say it, Ishna," Shallan said. "It's time to tell me."
I didn't know what they'd do with the money, Brightness," Ishna finally said. "I didn't mean for it. I mean, I was only trying to help."
"Money?" Radiant thought. "Drat," Vale thought. "We caught the wrong fish."
Shallan gave the conversation even more uncomfortable silence. People hated it and would often do anything to banish it.
"How did you know?" Ishna asked. "I have my ways."
"I should have guessed I couldn't keep it quiet," Ishna said. She seemed younger all of a sudden, fidgeting as she spoke. She was older than Shallan, but not by that much. Old enough to be seen as a full adult. Young enough to not believe it yet.
"My old friends in the underground came to me," Ishna said. "They were hard up, you know. We acted so tough, but that's the way you have to act. Pretend you're important. Pretend you're dangerous. All while you're actually scraping creme to get by. So I started giving them some of my stipend, ostensibly to help them pull themselves up and out of that life."
She put her hand to her forehead.
"Stormfather, I'm an idiot. Even I can hear how naive that sounds, saying it out loud. I should have known they just saw an opportunity in me. Everyone's a mark. Ishna got a good break, eh? What about the rest of us? Of course they'd use it to set up another racket.
I feel embarrassed, Vale thought. How did I miss hearing about this?
Well, Shallan said out loud, I'm glad to hear that you aren't intentionally funding a criminal enterprise.
Maybe we can clean it up quietly? It's not as bad as you might have heard, or, well, I guess I'm not a good one to judge that.
They bought up some gambling dens, started a protection scheme in one of the lower-end markets. My money bought them some enforcers, and I know they started using my name as proof they had authority. She sighed.
How much does the Queen know?
I'm honestly not sure, Shallan said. I haven't told her.
If it means anything, I cut them off last month, once I learned what they were doing.
Let's push a little harder, Vale decided. Mention Marais. Imply he was involved. See if she lets anything slip.
When did Marais get involved? Shallan asked.
Ishna cocked her head, scrunching up her brow.
Who?
The Ghost Bloods, Ishna. The shorter woman grew pale, and her hand genuinely seemed to be trembling as she put it back on the railing.
Stormfather! Did they?
They've contacted you, I know.
If they have, I didn't know it was them, Ishna said, shaken.
She slumped against the railing.
What happened? Was it that man that Den threatened? Was he Storm's Brightness? I've made a mess of this.
Shallan remained in place, hands clasped, trying to determine if it was an act. She couldn't persuade herself that it was. Ishna appeared legitimately shocked by the implication that the Ghost Bloods might have noticed her friend's little scheme. She even caught sight of a shame spren swimming through the beads toward them. Those were rare out here, as they were passing mountains in the physical realm where no one lived.
If she's lying, she's good enough to fool me, Vale said. I thought I'd escaped the underworld, Ishna whispered. I came to you, thinking you were someone powerful. Power was all I wanted. But then I saw something more. A way to be free. Everyone else lives such normal lives out in the light. No threads yanking toward the darkness. They seem happy. I suppose it was too much to assume I'd be able to really get away and belong in the light.
Storms. Shallan settled down and put her free hand on Ishna's shoulder, ashamed at having caused such pain in her friend.
That is a silly emotion, Vale thought. If Ishna wants out, we've done her a favor by exposing this.
And how would we feel, Shallan asked, if someone forced us to expose all our flaws, all our lies, and hung them in the open like an unfinished painting?
We'll deal with this when we return, Ishna, Shallan said. And I promise, I will help you clear it up. You've made a misstep, but we all make those as we seek our truths. You do belong in the light. You're there now. Stay there with me.
I will, Ishna said. For now, if you hear any mention of the Ghost Bloods, come directly to me.
Of course, Brightness. Thank you for not giving up on me completely, I mean.
Well done, Vale thought. Let's slip in a tidbit that might get fed to Marais if she reports to him.
I sincerely doubt she's the spy, Vale, Radiant said. You yourself indicated she couldn't fool you.
I didn't indicate that at all, Vale said. I said, if she's the spy, she's a better actor than I am, which would make her extremely dangerous. Shallan, find some bit of information to feed her that is distinct and interesting enough to be worth reporting, but something she's unlikely to talk about to the other members of the team. That felt like a tall order, but Vale wasn't willing to offer any more advice, so Shallan soldiered forward. "Hey," she said to Ishna, "just focus on helping with the mission. I like that you're taking notes on manifesting. Those will be useful." She nodded. "Is there anything else you want me to do?"
Shallan considered it, tapping her finger against the deck.
"Keep your eyes open for Spren that look odd," she said softly. "You remember Zha Anat?"
"Yes," Ishna said. Shallan had shared about the Unmade with her and a few others.
"I think I saw a corrupted Windspren flying past earlier. I can't be certain, so keep it to yourself. I don't want to alarm anyone. But if you're going to be sitting back here watching the manifesting, maybe keep an eye out. And if you see an odd Spren, let me know. All right?"
"I will. Thank you, Brightness, for your trust."
Shallan squeezed Ishna's arm encouragingly, then wandered away.
"How is that?" she asked.
"Not bad," Vale said. "Your warning will keep her from talking about it to the other Lightweavers, but corrupted Spren are also something Moraes is distinctly interested in. So, if she reports to him, she is likely to feed him the information. If you can find a way to tell the others you saw a different kind of corrupted Spren, we'll have planted just the right seed."
"I don't think it's going to work," Radiant said. "The idea is a clever one, but I can't see her reporting on such a minor detail to Moraes."
"You'd be surprised," Vale replied. "People are always eager to prove how important their mission is, and actively search for interesting things to report. Keep going, Shallan. You're doing very well." Feeling bolstered, she went to find Beryl. After the previous conversation, Ishna now seemed the least likely to be the spy, and Ishna had been helpful in identifying Iole's method of death. Besides, Moraes would know she had wanted to join the Ghost Bloods and would recognize that she'd draw suspicion. It was probably one of the other two, and Beryl was the obvious choice. Shallan hadn't failed to notice the way Starguile had dropped out of the mission at the last minute, with Beryl joining the team instead. A clear sign. But perhaps too obvious? Beryl was on soulcasting duty today. Yesterday, they'd stopped by a small strip of land representing a river in the physical realm and used pickaxes to cut out some chunks of obsidian ground. Shallan had quickly understood why the Spren of this realm didn't use obsidian for anything other than the occasional weapon. The rock was hard to work with, shattering like glass when struck. While it wouldn't make a good building material, they'd had success soulcasting it into food. The stone here was eager to be something else and could easily be persuaded to change. Today, Beryl knelt beside a stone they'd cut and was practicing turning it into food. Shallan lingered nearby, taking in Beryl's tall, alethy figure with luscious dark hair and a perfectly tan skin tone. She reminded Vale of Yasna, only more relaxed. "She uses light weaving to enhance her appearance," Vale noted. "Probably does it by instinct." Today, Beryl wore a long skirt rather than a true hava, along with a sleeveless top and a pair of silk gloves that went up to her elbows. She had removed her freehand glove and now reached out with delicate, supple fingers to caress the chunk of obsidian. She adopted an expression of concentration, and the chunk transformed to lavis grain in the blink of an eye. The clump of lavis held the shape of the obsidian for a moment, then collapsed, spreading out on the cloth underneath.
"Brightness?" Beryl asked, glancing up from her work. She was dark-eyed, like many camp followers, though that didn't really matter anymore.
Importantly, she had not yet earned her blade. "Am I doing something wrong?" Beryl had learned light weaving on her own, away from the structure and order of the Radiance. She was an unknown factor, a surge-binding savant who had come with her own spren already bonded. Shallan knelt and made a show of picking up a handful of grain and inspecting it. "You're not doing anything wrong at all. This is good work. Most of us have trouble making individual grains." "Oh, it helps to have a seed," she said, pulling some from her pocket. "Literal seeds, in this case." She grinned, holding them up. "If you have something to show the obsidian soul, you intrigue it enough to want to transform."
"That's not how Yasna does it," Vale said.
"Yeah, Vatha told me. But my way works better for him, too. Queen Yasna doesn't know everything, right?" She smiled brightly. "Or maybe it's different for our order. It's not her fault if she doesn't know how lightweavers work."
"Storms," Vale thought. "I always forget how downright sunny Beryl can be."
Shallan folded her arms, thinking back to her own troubles with soul casting. Could it be that all along the problem hadn't been her, but Yasna's training method? They'd assumed two orders using the same power would be analogous. The Skybreakers and the Windrunners seemed to fly the same way after all. Then again, the way that light weaving worked for Truth Watchers seemed different, even if one disregarded whatever Renarin was. So maybe?
"Focus," Vale thought. "Try nudging her to be uncomfortable. Find out if she's hiding something."
Shallan opened her mouth to make a comment like she had to Ishna. Something else entirely came out. "Are you actually happy?" Shallan asked. "Brightness?" Beryl asked, still sitting on a box next to some chunks of obsidian. "Happy?" "There's a lightness about you," Shallan said. "Is it real? Or are you hiding the pain?"
"I think we all hide pain to an extent," Beryl said. "But I don't think I'm in particular agony."
"And your past?" Shallan asked. "It doesn't haunt you?"
"I won't pretend my life was easy. The profession isn't an easy one, and the women who find their way to it often have their problems magnified. There are ways to keep it from chewing you up, however. To make it your choice, done in your way." She grimaced. "Or at least, ways to tell yourself that."
Shallan nodded and heard a humming behind her. Pattern, her pattern, had wandered over and was inspecting Beryl's soul-casting handiwork.
"By the end," Beryl continued, "I had a lot of control over the men who came to me. I liked becoming the woman they wanted. It wasn't until you came searching for me, though, that I realized the truth."
She looked straight at Shallan.
"That I could walk away if I wanted to. Nothing was keeping me there. Not any longer. I could have left months earlier. Odd, isn't it?"
"That's how it always is," Vale said.
"Pardon brightness, but it's not. A lot of the women are worse off than me. They couldn't simply leave. It was the moss for some, threats for others. Some of us, though..."
She looked at her hand and let the seeds drop into the pile.
"We talk about transformation, the Almighty's greatest blessing to humans, the ability to change. Sometimes we need a seed too, eh?"
Shallan shuffled, looking to the side as Vatha walked by, with one of the Peakspren sailors. Maybe she should go talk to him, see if he was the spy.
"You're uncomfortable around Beryl," Radiant thought. "Is it because she seems to have a greater handle on her life, when you assume she should be worse at it?"
"Feelings, feelings," Vale said. "Blah, blah, blah. Shallan, stay on topic, please."
Shallan found her mind spiraling around her past, the things she had done, the things she was still hiding from, wearing this face that she pretended was her own, that she pretended she deserved. Shallan could be happy, but that happiness was built on lies. Would it not be better to accept what she really was? Become the person she deserved to be? Formless, who had been hiding deep inside these last few days, stirred. She'd thought him forgotten, but he had been waiting, watching. "Help," Shallan whispered. "Brightness?" Beryl asked. Radiant stood up straight, no longer lounging. "You are to be commended for your diligence, Beryl. You say that this method of soul casting has helped Votha. Have you shown it to any of the others yet?"
"No, not yet.
I would like you to approach Ishna and train her in it. Report to me the results of the experiment."
"I will," Beryl said. You seem different. Did you become one of the others?"
"I have merely realized I have a great deal yet to do today," Radiant said. That caused Pattern to hum. "Continue your efforts." She moved to leave, then pretended to reconsider, and stepped back, speaking softly. "We need to be careful. I saw a glory spren earlier that appeared odd. I think that Ja'anat, the corrupter of spren, is watching us. Report to me if you see any odd glory spren. But stay very quiet about this to the others. I do not wish to inspire a panic." Beryl nodded.
"That's a little straightforward and blunt, Radiant," Vale said. "The goal is to not act suspicious."
"I do as I can," Radiant thought. "And I am not suited to subterfuge."
"Liar," Vale said. "Shallan, kid, you all right?"
But Shallan had pulled into a knot within Radiant.
"It was the conversation that set her off," Vale said. "Something about it.
About leaving your old life and finding a new one?" Shallan whimpered.
"I see," Vale said, retreating as well.
Great. She'd lost both of them. Well, Radiant's job was to see that things got done. She walked after Votha. Pattern stayed behind with Beryl, watching her work. Votha was carrying a large pole that was at least 30 feet long. What was he up to? Regardless, in Radiant's estimation, Votha was suspicious in an entirely different way from the other two. Votha had always been the most dark of the former deserters, and she understood why. Following something? Believing in something? Then abandoning it? Leaving your companions in arms? It was a horrifying thought. She usually let the others deal with him. A lot of the other deserters she'd come to understand. Gaz had run from gambling debts, and Issam from a cruel captain in Sadius's army who constantly beat him. But Votha, his true past was still a mystery. He was cruel and possibly corrupt. He had returned with Shallan only because the circumstances had been right. Shallan liked to think she'd changed the deserters, shown them the nobler side of their personalities. While she might be correct about the others, Radiant wasn't certain about Votha. If he had deserted once, he was capable of it again. And Storms, he didn't look at all like he belonged with the rest of the court. Even cleaned up and wearing work clothing, Votha looked rough, like he'd recently gotten out of bed after collapsing into it drunk. He was never properly shaved, but also never ended up with a full beard. Votha climbed the few steps up to the prow of the barge, the section where the mandras were harnessed. Radiant marched up after him. A female Peakspren sailor instructed Votha to heft the long pole so that the tip went high in the air and the bottom end slipped through a ring at the front of the barge. Once he'd done so, Votha began lowering the pole slowly, hand over hand. The butt of the pole passed between the mandra harness lines to hit the beads beneath. "They're measuring depth," Radiant thought.
He's doing sailor jobs. Like yesterday. Strange.
Hold it steady, the Peaksbren said to Votha. Brace it against the prow of the barge. Yes, keep going.
Votha continued lowering the pole. The current of the beads below was clearly stronger than a current of water would be, and it pressed the pole backward. The rings on the front of the ship were there to keep the force of the beads from pulling the pole out of his hands.
Keep going, the Peaksbren said. Slower, though.
Votha grunted, continuing to lower the depth gauge.
They use weighted strings in my world. Wouldn't work here. I just bumped something, he said. Yeah, that's the bottom. Huh. Not as far down as I thought it would be. We've entered the shallows, the Peaksbren said,
helping him raise the pole.
Skirting to the west of the great trench we call the Radiant Depths.
Votha got the pole up and walked to stow it along the railing. Then the Spren tossed him a brush. Votha nodded and walked toward the water station. The metal device fed on stormlight to somehow make water. What is this task? Radiant asked, following after him.
Deck needs to be scrubbed, he said. They don't wash them here as often as they do on ships back home. Guess they don't need to, without ocean water spilling up on everything. Planks don't need tar to keep them waterproof either.
You were a sailor? Radiant asked, surprised.
I've done a lot of jobs.
He filled up a bucket, then picked a section of the deck and went to work, kneeling and scrubbing at the wood. I'm impressed, Radiant said. I had not thought you would be one to volunteer for work, Votha.
It needs to be done.
It is good to work the body, but I find myself objecting to that statement. The Peaksbren seemed to have continued for a while without the deck being washed. She folded her arms, then shrugged and moved to get a brush herself. As she returned, Votha glanced at her with a dark expression.
Did you simply come to taunt me, Radiant? Or is there a point?
I suppose it's easy to tell me apart from the others, isn't it?
Vale would never have decided to help, he said, continuing to brush. She'd have mocked me for doing extra work. Shallan would be off somewhere drawing or reading. So, here we are.
Indeed, Radiant said, kneeling and scrubbing alongside him. You are an observant man, Votha.
Observant enough to know you want something from me. What is it?
I'm merely curious, she said. The Votha I know would have avoided work and found a place to relax.
Relaxing isn't relaxing, he said. Sit around too much, and you start sitting around even more.
He kept brushing.
Go across the planks, rather than up and down them. So you don't wear grooves. Yeah, like that. This does need to be done. The sailors used to scrub the wood every month, but they haven't had as much help lately. Something about reachers not being around? What are reachers, anyway?
They're a specific bronze-skinned kind of Spren, Radiant said. They were sailors on our previous voyage.
Well, they aren't around as much to hire these days, I guess, Votha said.
Did the others say why?
I didn't ask, Votha said.
How odd, Radiant said. Now, how could she get to the topic of a corrupted Spren? She considered, and began to regard this as a silly exercise. Why not ask him if he was the spy? If she was firm enough, he'd admit to his wrongdoing. She opened her mouth to do just that, but had enough common sense to stop herself. This was not a good idea, was it? Having her do espionage? No, Shallan thought, emerging with a sigh. I guess it isn't. Hey, Shallan said to Votha as they scrubbed. You know we're a family, right? The court? The group of us? You don't have to always go off alone and punish yourself.
Not punishing myself, he growled. Just wanted to be busy and away from questions. Everyone asks too many questions when they get bored.
You don't have to answer them, she said. Really, Vatha, you're one of us, and we accept you, as you are. He glanced at her, then sat back on his knees, dripping brush in hand. Shallan did likewise, noting that she'd scuffed her trousers. Radiant was always too eager to throw herself into labor, never worrying about her clothing.
Shallan, he said.
She nodded. Vatha returned to his work and didn't speak as he continued to scrub. Unlike Ishna, he was perfectly willing to let silence hang. It was harder for Shallan, but she did. For a time, the only sound was that of bristles on wood.
Does it work? Vatha finally asked. These three faces you put on, does it actually help you somehow?
It does, Shallan said. It really does. Most of the time, at least.
Can't decide if I envy you or not, Vatha replied. I'd like to be able to pretend. Something broke in me, you know? A long time ago. You used to be a good soldier. You used to care. But then you see what you've done. Legitimately see it. And realize everything you fought for was a sham. What do polished buttons matter when you've got a child's blood on your boots?
He scrubbed harder at a spot on the deck.
Figure if I learn to lightweave well enough, maybe I'll turn into someone else.
That stabbed her straight through. Strength, Shallan, Radiant thought. Strength before weakness.
Wouldn't that be a blessing? Vatha continued. To become someone else? Someone new?
You can do that without light weaving, Shallan said.
Can I? Vatha asked. Can you? We've got a blessing in this power, he continued. Let's us turn into other people.
It's not a blessing, Shallan whispered. It's survival.
Feels worse in this place, Vatha said, eyeing the sky. I always feel like something is watching me.
Yeah, Shallan said. The other day I caught a spren swimming alongside the boat, watching me. One of those fear spren, the long eel-like ones on this side.
What color was it? Vatha asked. Was it hers?
Yeah, Shallan whispered. I didn't tell the others. Didn't want them worried.
Smart, Vatha said. Well, Ja'anat is something else for me to worry about. I'll have to double-check every storming spren now.
Let me know if you see anything, Shallan said. But don't trouble the others. Not yet. Not until we know for certain what she wants. Vatha nodded.
Nice work, Vale thought at her, emerging from her contemplation. That was smooth, Shallan.
We'll think of ways to push him for secrets he might be hiding later.
For now, this was a good day's work.
I hate that I'm back to acting like an apprentice, Shallan thought back. You learned all this from Tin. Why do we need to learn it again?
We learned it, Vale thought. But we never tried it out. Remember, we are new to this, despite what we might pretend.
It was hard for Vale to acknowledge that she didn't actually have years of experience. Hard for her to admit that she was an alter, a part of Shallan's personality, manifesting as a distinct person. But it was a good reminder, one that Radiant often brought up. They were learning, and they weren't experts. Not yet. Still, Shallan did know a few things about people. Though Vale wanted to move on, Shallan knelt beside Vatha. Hey, she said. Whatever you did, it's behind you. We accept you, Vatha. The unseen court is a family.
A family, he said with a grunt. Never had one of those before.
I knew it, she said softly.
What? That I was lonely?
No, she said solemnly. That you were the child of a couple of particularly ugly rocks. He glared at her. You know, she said, since you have no family, must be rocks. It makes sense.
Really? We were having a moment.
She smiled, putting her hand on his shoulder. It's okay, Vatha. I appreciate your sentiment. She got up to go.
Hey,
Vatha said as she walked away. She glanced back at him.
Thanks for smiling.
She nodded before continuing on her way. What you said applies to us too, Radiant thought. That what we did in the past doesn't matter. I suppose, Shallan thought. You don't mean that, Vale accused her. You think what you did was worse. You're always willing to give others more charity than you extend yourself. Shallan didn't respond. I'm figuring it out, Shallan, Vale said. Why you keep working with Marais? Why you won't tell Adolin what this is all about? It has to do with what you said earlier. When, not now, Shallan said. But, in response, Shallan retreated and Radiant found herself in control. And no amount of prodding would bring Shallan back. 27. Banners.
That said, the most worrying thing I discovered in this was the wound upon the spiritual realm, where ambition, mercy, and odium clashed. And ambition was destroyed. The effects on the planet Threnody have been disturbing.
Navani had always found war banners to be curious things. The wind was crisp and cold on Urethiru's outer platform today, and it made the banners, brilliant Colin blue, with Dalinar's glyph pair emblazoned on them, crack with the sound of breaking sticks. They seemed alive up there on their poles, writhing like captive sky eels among the windspren. Today the banners waved above waiting battalions. 1,000 men at a time stood for their turn at the Oath Gate, where Radiance transferred them to Aesir. With a flash, a ring of light rising around the plateau, both men and banners were off, sent hundreds of miles in a heartbeat. Navani appreciated the aesthetic nature of banners, the way they marked divisions, battalions, companies. At the same time, there was a strange incongruity to them. It was essential to keep your men organized and engaged on the battlefield. Dalinar said far more battles were lost by improper discipline than by lack of bravery. But the banners also acted like enormous arrows, pointing the way to the most important men on the field. Banners were targets, bold proclamations that here was where you'd find someone to kill. They were symbols of an organized army, helmed by men and women who knew the best way to end you, if only you'd do them the favor of wandering in their direction.
You look preoccupied, Dalinar said as he stepped over, trailed by an honor guard of 10 men.
I'm thinking about symbols and why we use them, Navani said, trying not to think about you leaving again. He reached down to cup her cheek. Who had known those hands could be so tender? She placed her hand alongside his face. His skin always felt rough. She swore she'd touched his cheek right after he'd shaved, and still found it ragged like sandpaper. The honor guard stood tall and tried to ignore Dalinar and Navani. Even this little sign of affection wasn't particularly a lethe. That was what they told themselves, anyway. The stoic warriors, not ruined by emotion. That was their banner, never mind that for centuries one of the unmade had driven their lust for battle to a frenzy. Never mind that they were human, like any others. They had emotions. They displayed them. They merely pretended to ignore them. In the same way you might tactfully ignore a man who accidentally went about with his trousers undone.
"Watch him, Dalinar," Navani whispered. "He will try something."
"I know," Dalinar said.
Taravangian was walking up the slope onto the platform for the next transfer. Through some careful finagling, his honor guard was a Lethi, and Dalinar planned to station the man's armies away from the command post on another part of the Azish front, with extra soldiers in between to protect his flank from a potential double cross. It was an unfortunately obvious move. Taravangian would realize he was being kept hostage after a fashion to ensure the loyalty of his troops. As an extra protection, a singular secret weapon hid among Dalinar's servants. Zeth, wearing the face of a common soldier, had been assigned to guard Dalinar. Navani couldn't spot him, so the disguise, maintained by one of Shallan's light weavers, was working. Though the sheath to his strange sword had required some physical decorations and disguises, as a light weaving wouldn't stick to it. So she thought she could pick him out as the one with the oversized weapon at his waist. Another light weaver had created an illusion of Zeth in his jail cell. If Taravangian had people reporting on Zeth, they'd indicate he was safely locked up. They wouldn't know he was instead staying very close to Dalinar. Though she hated the idea, Navani had to admit that Zeth had remained in prison all these months, without a single incident. He seemed obedient to Dalinar without question. And if Zeth could be trusted, there was likely no better guard. Almighty send that the cure was not worse than the disease. Beyond that, Navani couldn't help wondering if, even in all this, they were being manipulated by Taravangian. Surely he wouldn't want them to surround him with enemy troops. Surely she misread the clever turn of the old man's lips, the knowing look in his eyes. But now it was time for Dalinar to leave. So, Navani carefully tucked away her anxiety and embraced him. He plainly wasn't thrilled to get a hug in front of his soldiers, but he didn't say anything. After that, the two of them went to meet the governess who had brought little Gav with his trunks of things. The young boy, trying hard not to look too eager, saluted Dalinar.
"It is a big duty," Dalinar told him. "Going to war for the first time. Are you ready?"
"I am, sir," the child said. "I'll fight well."
"You won't be fighting," Dalinar said. "And neither will I. We'll be handling strategy."
"I'm good at that," Gav said. Then he gave Navani a hug.
The governess led him toward the Oathgate building. Navani watched with worry.
"He's young to be going."
"I know," Dalinar said. "But I owe him this. He feels terrified to be left behind again in a palace while..."
He left it unsaid. Navani knew there was more. Things Dalinar had said about how he'd been angry when younger, and had prevented Adolin and Renarin from spending time with him when they wanted to. Well, the child should be safe, and he really did deserve more time with Dalinar. She held his hand for a season, then let him go. He tramped up the slope toward the Oathgate as a half dozen anxious scribes scurried over to ask him questions. Navani composed herself, then went to say farewell to her daughter, who would also be going on the expeditionary force. She spotted the queen arriving via palanquin. Curiously, Yasna, who often took extra care not to seem weak, almost always used a palanquin these days, and Taravangian, who truly needed one, refused the distinctive treatment. Taravangian seemed weaker while walking, while Yasna seemed stronger when carried, more confident, in control.
Which is exactly how each of them wishes to appear, Navani thought, as the porters lowered Yasna's palanquin and she emerged. Though her hava, her hair, and her makeup were immaculate, Yasna wore little in the way of ornamentation. She wanted to be seen as regal, but not excessive.
No wit? Navani asked.
He promised to meet me in Aesir, Yasna said. He vanishes sometimes, and won't grace my questions with answers, not even mocking ones.
There's something odd about that one, Yasna.
You have no idea, Mother.
The two of them stood facing one another, until finally Yasna reached forward. What followed was the most awkward hug Navani had ever been part of, both of them making the proper motions, but unenthusiastic at the same time. Yasna pulled back. She was regal. Technically, they were both of a similar rank, yet there'd always been something about Yasna. Dalinar was a big rock of a man that you wanted to prod until you found out what kind of crystals were inside. Yasna, well, Yasna was just unknowable.
Storms, Yasna said under her breath. Mother, are we really so awkward that we embrace like teenagers meeting a boy for the first time?
I don't want to ruin your image, Navani said.
A woman can hug her mother, can't she? My reputation won't come crashing down because I showed affection.
Still, she didn't lean in for another. Instead, she took Navani's hand.
I apologize. I haven't had much time for family lately. I always told myself that when I finished my travels, I'd work diligently to be available to you all. I recognize that family relations need attendant time to...
Yasna took a deep breath, then pressed her safe hand against her forehead.
I sound like a historical treatise, not a person, don't I?
You have a lot of pressure on you, dear, Navani said.
Pressure that I asked for and welcome, Yasna said. The quickest changes in history often happen during times of strife, and these are important moments. But you're important, too, to me. Thank you for always being you, despite the rise of kingdoms and the fall of peoples. I don't think you can understand how much your constant strength means to me.
What an unusual exchange. Yet Navani found herself smiling. She squeezed Yasna's hand, and that moment together, seeing through the mask, became more precious than 100 awkward embraces.
Watch little Gav for me, Navani said. I don't know what I think of him going with Dalinar. Boys younger than him go on campaign.
To locations not so near the battlefront, Navani said. It was a fine distinction that many of their allies misunderstood. But these days, with fused who could fly, anywhere could become a battlefront.
I'll make sure he keeps well away from the fighting, Yasna promised.
Navani nodded. Your uncle feels that he failed Adolin and Renarin's children by spending so long in the field, and so little of it with them when they were young. He intends to make up for it now. I don't dislike the sentiment, but just keep an eye on them both for me, please.
Yasna retreated to her palanquin, and Navani stepped back. The banners continued to applaud as Dalinar's best soldiers arranged themselves with him, the queen, and Taravangian. Though the chill air sliced through her shawl, Navani was determined to stay and watch until she had word via Spanreed that they'd arrived in Aesir. As she waited, Sabariel wandered past. The portly bearded man had taken to wearing clothing that was more appropriate to his overall look. Something reminiscent of a Thalen merchant's clothing, with trousers and a vest, under a long Alethi officer's coat, meant to be left unbuttoned.
Navani wasn't certain if Polona was to credit for the transformation, or if Adolin had finally gotten to the High Prince, but it was a marked improvement on the Takama ensemble Sabariel had once favored. Most of the High Princes were out in the field on Dalinar's orders. It was a Lethi tradition. Being a leader was essentially the same as being a general. If a king went to war, High Princes would go with him. That was so ingrained in them that it was hard to remember that other cultures, like both the Azish and the Thalans, did it differently. Not many of the original High Princes remained. They'd been forced to replace Vama, Thanadol, and, most recently, Sadius, with distant scions loyal to Dalinar and Yasna. But building a reputation and a princedom in exile was a difficult task. Rowian's son struggled for precisely that reason. They had three they could count on: Aladar, Sabariel, and Hatham. Bathab and his wife had fallen into line, which left Ruthar the lone holdout of hostility, the last remnant of Sadius's faction against Dalinar. Navani picked out the man with his retinue preparing to leave with Dalinar's force. Ruthar would present a problem, but if Navani were to guess, Yasna would find a way to deal with him soon. Her daughter hated loose ends. Hopefully, whatever Yasna did wouldn't be too dramatic. Sabariel was staying behind to help administer the tower, and he offered his own set of difficulties. "So," he said to Navani, "we're taking bets on how long it takes Terra Vangian to knife us in the back?" "Hush," Navani said. "Thing is," Sabariel said, "I kind of respect the old goof. If I manage to live as long as him, I can imagine throwing up my hands and trying to take over the world. I mean, at that point, what do you have to lose?"
"Your integrity."
"Integrity doesn't stop men from killing brightness," Sabariel said. "It just makes them use different justifications."
"Glib, but meaningless," Navani said. "Do you really want to draw moral equivalency between wholesale conquest and resisting the Voidbringer invasion? Do you genuinely believe that a man of integrity is the same as a murderer?"
He chuckled. "You have me there, Brightness. You seem to have discovered my one great weakness, actually listening to anything I say. You might be the only person in all of Roshar who takes me seriously."
Light rose in a ring around the Oathgate platform, swirling into the air. A scribe stood nearby at her workstation, waiting for Spanreed confirmation of the army's arrival. "I'm not the only one who takes you seriously, Turinad," Navani told Sabariel. "There's at least one more."
"If she took me seriously, Brightness, I'd be a married man," he sighed. "I can't decide if she thinks me unworthy of her, or if somehow she's decided a high prince shouldn't marry someone of her station. When I try to get it out of her, the response is never clear."
"Could be neither option," Navani said.
"If that's the case, I'm at a complete loss."
The scribe changed the flag outside her workstation. Green for a successful transfer, with a red flag underneath, meaning people were still leaving the other platform, and it wasn't ready for another transfer yet.
Another use for banners, Navani thought. They could at times be more effective than a span read. You could look down from the 20th floor and see a flag much more quickly than you could write out a question and receive a response.
Reputations were banners also. Yasna had crafted a distinctive persona. People halfway around the world knew about her. Dalinar had done the same thing. Not as deliberately, but with equal effect. But what banner did Navani want to fly? She turned with Sabariel and walked toward the tower. She'd originally come to the Shattered Plains to chase something new,
a different life, one that she wanted, rather than one she thought she should want. Yet here she found herself doing the same things as before, running a kingdom for a man who was too grand to be contained by simple day-to-day tasks. The love she felt for this man was different, true, deeper, and there was certainly a fulfilling satisfaction to bringing order to the chaos of a newly born kingdom like Urethiru. It presented unique challenges, both logistical and political. Was it selfish to want something more? This was what she seemed to be good at doing, and it was where the Almighty had placed her. She was one of the most powerful women in the world. Why would she think she deserved more? Together with Sabariel, she entered the tower by its broad front gates. The temperature change was immediate, though with these broad gates standing open all day, the inner foyer should have been as cold as the plateau outside. "You want me to return to the war camps, I assume?" Sabariel asked. "I still have some interests working in the area."
"Yes. By the time my husband returns, I want those camps fully under our control again."
"You know," Sabariel said, "some wouldn't trust me with such a duty. My vices align well with the delights offered by the region."
"We'll see. Of course, if you fail to bring order to the war camps, then I'll need to impose martial law. Tragic, wouldn't you say? Closing down all of those entrepreneurs? Destroying the single place that is under Alethi rule, but which also offers an escape from the strict oversight of the Radiants? If only someone with precisely the right mindset would watch the war camps and make sure they become safe for travelers, and that the nearby lumber operations are proceeding without interruption. Someone who could see the need for law while also understanding that it's not a terrible thing to be a little more relaxed, to let good Alethi citizens live their lives safely, but without being under my husband's direct glare." Sabariel laughed.
"How much do you suppose I can pocket before Dalinar would find my thieving too blatant?"
"Stay under 5%, Navani said.
4 9/10 it is, Sabariel said, bowing to her. "I'll be practically respectable brightness. Perhaps Pallona will finally see that I can be useful, if given the proper motivation."
"Turi," Navani said.
"Yes, brightness?" he asked,
rising from the flowery bow. "If a man takes nothing in his life seriously, it makes a woman wonder. What is she? Another joke? Another whim?"
"Surely she knows her value to me, brightness."
"Surely there is no problem in making it clear." Navani patted him on the arm. "It is difficult not to question your value to someone who seems to value nothing. Sincerity might not come easily for you, but when she finds it in you, she'll value it even more for the scarcity."
"Yes. All right. Thank you."
He waddled off, and Navani watched him go with genuine fondness. That was incredible, considering her former opinion of the man. But he'd stood with them, whether through intent or accident, when most others had refused. Beyond that, she'd found he could be trusted to get things done. Like everyone, deep down, he wanted to be useful. Humans were orderly beings. They liked to see lots of straight lines, if only so, in some cases, they could be the one drawing curves. And if a tool seemed broken at first glance, perhaps you were simply applying it to the wrong task. Once in the tower, Navani took a palanquin inward, attended by Brightness and Nisa, who brought various reports for Navani to inspect. Navani passed over the sanitation figures, instead reading up on water distribution through the tower, as well as reports of foot traffic in the stairwells. There were more random fights and arguments in Urethiru than there had been in Dalinar's war camp. Part of that was the diverse population, but she suspected that keeping everyone in relatively tight confines was a culprit as well. Dalinar wanted to post more guard patrols, but if she could divert traffic flow to keep people from jostling one another. She had some ideas mapped out by the time her palanquin reached the atrium at the far eastern edge of the tower. She stepped out into one of the city's most dynamic locations, a place where a vast corridor stretched tens and tens of floors upward, almost to the roof. While lifts ran up and down the large artery that led inward to the atrium, and there were a multitude more stairwells, this was the sole place one could catch a lift all the way to the top floor. Stretching along the eastern wall was an enormous window, hundreds of feet tall. The tiers of Urethiru weren't full circles. Most were closer to half circles, with the flat side aligned here at the atrium, so you could look all the way up or stare out toward the origin. As one of the brighter sections of the tower, and with its many lifts, the area bustled with traffic. That made it all the more remarkable that the atrium, of all places, had hidden an architectural mystery. Navani crossed the circular chamber to the far wall, just to the left side of the window. A few days back, one of her scribes had noted an oddity here, a small division in the rock, too straight to be a crack. With Dalinar's permission, a stone ward had been called in to shape the rock into an opening. They could make stone soft to their touch. Navani's morning report had indicated she should come see the results, but this was the first time she'd been able to pull away. But Dali, a stone ward, guarded the door. He was an affable older man with a powdery beard and smiling eyes. He bowed to her as she stepped through his newly made door. Falilar, the engineer, was already inside, measuring what they'd discovered. A large room, hidden entirely in the stone.
"Brightness," Brightness Anissa said, walking alongside her. "What was the purpose of sealing off an entire room like this?"
Navani shook her head. This wasn't the only room they'd found in the tower with apparently no entrances. This one was particularly significant, though, for it had a large picture window along the rear wall, which let in the sunlight. Standing in front of that window was an odd structure, a tall stone model of the tower. She'd read about it in the report, but as she approached, she was still surprised by its intricacy. The thing was a good 15 feet tall and was divided in two, the halves pulled apart, to give a cross-section of the tower. At this scale, floors weren't even an inch tall, but everything she saw about them was reproduced in intricate detail, at least as much as was allowed at that scale. Falilar joined her beside it, holding a notebook full of figures. "What do you make of it, Brightness?"
"I have no idea," she said. "Why put this here, but then seal it off?"
She bent over, noting that the crystal pillar room, along with the two library rooms nearby, was represented in the model. Falilar used a small reed to point.
"See here? This room itself is reproduced, with a tiny representation of this very model. But there is an open door leading in where there wasn't one in the real tower."
"So the rooms were sealed off before the Radiance left?"
"Or," Falilar said, "they could open and close some other way. When the tower was abandoned, some were already closed, others open."
"That would explain a lot." They'd found so many rooms with actual doors, or the remnants of ones rotted away, that she hadn't considered that there might be other mechanisms on undiscovered rooms. A clearly biased approach. She glanced at the wall they'd come in through.
Did that stone ward discover any mechanism for such an opening?
There was a gemstone embedded in the stone, Falalar said. I had him get it out for us to inspect. I intend to have him see if perhaps the rock was somehow intended to slide open to the sides there. If so, it would be a remarkable mechanism.
Navani made a mental note to have one of the Windrunners fly out to do a close inspection of the mountains that Urethiru was built into. Perhaps windows like this one would reveal other hidden rooms with equally mysterious contents.
I'll do a thorough inspection of this model, Falalar said. It might yield secrets.
Thank you. I unfortunately have some sanitation reports to read.
If you get a chance, stop by the library and talk to my nephew, Falalar said. He's made some improvements on his device.
Navani nodded and started back toward her palanquin, trusting Falalar to send her whatever he discovered. As she was climbing into the palanquin, she saw Isabi, one of her younger scholars, rush into the room, holding a blinking red light. The mysterious span reed, the one she'd received weeks ago from the unknown person who was so angry about Fabriel's. It was the first time they had tried to contact her since that day. Sanitation reports would wait. 28. Heresies.
Other shards I cannot identify and are hidden to me. I fear that their influence encroaches upon my world, yet I am locked into a strange inability because of the opposed powers I hold.
Hold it steady, Falalar said.
It had been years since Navani had seen the old white-bearded engineer this animated.
Put it here on the table. Isabi, you have the scale? Yes? Hurry, hurry. Set it up like we practiced.
The small swarm of ardents and scholars fussed around Navani, settling the span reed into its board and preparing standard violet ink. They'd carried it out and set it up in a guard post near the perimeter of the tower. Calamy stood next to Navani, her arms folded. Hair streaked with grey, the scribe had an increasingly worrisome leanness to her these days.
I'm not sure about this brightness, she said, as the engineer and his assistants set up their instruments. I worry that whoever is on the other side of that span reed, they'll learn more about us than we do about them.
Falalar wiped his shaved head with a handkerchief, then gestured for Navani to sit at the table.
Noted, Navani said to Calamy, settling down. We ready?
Yes, brightness, Falalar said. Judging by the weight of your pen, once the conversation is engaged, we should be able to tell how far away the other pen is.
Span reeds had a certain decay to them. The farther apart they were, the heavier the pens became after activation. In most cases, this was a slight, almost imperceptible difference. Today, the span reed board, with pen attached, had been placed on Falalar's most precise scale. The pen was hooked by strings to other instruments as well. Navani carefully turned the ruby, indicating she was ready to communicate with her phantom correspondent. The six scholars and ardents, Calamy included, seemed to hold their collective breath. The pen started writing. Why have you ignored my instructions? Falalar gestured animatedly to the others, who began taking measurements, adding tiny weights to the balance, and reading the tension in the pull of the string. She left them to their measurements, instead focusing on the conversation.
I'm not sure what exactly you expected of me, she wrote. Please, explain further.
You must stop your experiments with Fabriel's, the reed wrote. I made it explicitly clear that you needed to stop. You have not. You have only increased your heresies. What is this you do, putting Fabriel's in a pit and connecting them to the blowing of the storms?
Do you make a weapon of the Spren you have trapped? Do you kill? Humans always kill.
Heresies, Calamy noted as the engineers worked. Whoever it is seems to have a theological opposition to our actions.
She references humans as a singer might, Navani said, tapping the paper. Either she's one of them, or she wants us to think she is.
Brightness, Falalar said. This can't be correct. The decay is almost non-existent.
So they're near to us, Navani said.
Extremely near, Falalar said. Inside the tower. If we could figure out a way to make more precise scales... Regardless, a second measurement would help me with possible triangulation.
Navani nodded. Why do you call this a heresy? Navani wrote. The church sees no moral problem with Fabrials. No more than they have a problem with hitching a chul to a cart.
A chul hitched to a cart is not confined to a tiny space, the reply came, the pen moving furiously, animatedly. Spren are meant to be free. By capturing them, you trap nature itself. Can a storm survive if placed in a prison? Can a flower bloom with no sunlight? This is what you do. Your religion is incomplete.
Let me think on this, Navani wrote. I will need a few minutes to speak with my theological advisor.
Each moment you wait is a moment of pain brought to the Spren you dominate, the pen wrote. I will not suffer it for much longer.
Please wait, Navani wrote. I will use another span read for a moment to talk to my theological advisor, but then will respond to you soon. No response came, but the pen continued to hover. The phantom was waiting.
All right, she said. Let's get the second measurement.
The engineers moved with a flurry of activity, disjoining the span read so the link between the two pens was temporarily broken. They gathered the equipment and started running. Navani and Calamy hurried into the palanquin waiting for them outside the room. A group of six men hefted it and charged after the engineers and scribes as the entire group rushed through the tower. They eventually burst out onto the plateau in front of Urethiru. You couldn't tell the direction of a second span read, not directly, even from the decay. However, because you could measure the decay, and therefore judge distance, you could triangulate from multiple measurements and get a rough idea of location. The team set up out here, on the plateau, among the cold Spren. By the time she climbed free of the palanquin, Falalar and his team had the span read ready on the stone ground. Navani knelt and re-engaged the device. They waited, Falalar dabbing at his head with his handkerchief, Calamy kneeling beside the paper and whispering, "Come on!" Falalar's little apprentice, Isabi, daughter to one of the windrunners, seemed ready to burst as she held her breath. The pen engaged, then wrote, "Why did you move? What are you doing?"
"I have spoken to my Ardens," Navani wrote, as the engineers again began taking measurements. "They agree that our knowledge must be flawed."
"Can you explain how you know that this is evil? How is it you know what our Ardens do not?"
"How does she know we moved?" Calamy asked.
"She has a spy watching us," Navani said. "Probably the same person who hid the span read ruby for me to find." The person on the end didn't reply.
"I have many duties," Navani wrote. "You interrupted me on my way to an important meeting. I have a few more minutes now to talk. Please, tell us how you know what we don't."
"The truth is evident to me," the pen wrote.
"It is not obvious to us," Navani wrote. "Because you are human," it replied. "Humans cannot be trusted. You do not know how to keep promises, and promises are what make the world function. We make the world function.
You must release your captive, Spren. You must.
Ash's mask, Calamy said. It's a Spren, isn't it?
Yes, Navani said.
I have measurements, Falalar said. It is coming from the tower. I should be able to pin it down to a specific region. I must say, Brightness, you don't seem surprised by any of this.
I had my suspicions, Navani said. We found one ancient Spren hiding in the tower. Is it such a stretch to assume a second has done the same?
Another of the unmade? Calamy asked.
Navani tapped her finger against the spanreed paper, thinking.
I doubt it, she said.
A Spren who wishes to free its kind? A liberation Spren? Has anyone heard of such a thing? The scholars collectively shook their heads. Navani reached to write further to the phantom, but the spanreed shut off, dropping to the paper, no longer actively conjoined.
So, what do we do? Calamy asked. Another of those things could be watching us from the darkness, planning more murders.
It's not the same, Navani said. There's something here. We make the world function. As they gathered up their things, a plan began budding in Navani's mind. A touch reckless, particularly since she didn't want to explain it to the others where the Spren might be able to hear. She went ahead with the idea, anyway. As they were walking to the tower proper, Navani stumbled, and trying to make it appear as accidental as possible, dropped the span reed while walking. She cried out as she clumsily kicked it across the stone plateau, right over the edge. She rushed over, but it had already vanished, tumbling to the rocks thousands of feet below.
The span reed, Falalar said. Oh, Brightness.
Damnation, she said. That's terrible. Calamy eyed her, walking up. Navani smothered a smile. Falalar, Navani said. Gather a team to see if they can recover that. I need to take better care.
Yes, Brightness, he said.
Of course, if they did find it, the team would have discreet directions to break the ruby, as if from the fall. And, of course, they would be instructed to speak loudly of the tragedy of it among her scholars in the tower. Navani had a budding suspicion as to the identity of this Spren who had contacted her. She wanted to make sure that it, and its agent, heard of the lost spanreed.
Let's see what you do now, Navani thought, strolling back into the tower.
Shallan's sketchbook. Ash Spren. This gesture was directed at us on more than one occasion. The Ash Spren's lips momentarily blow away, exposing teeth in a sneer that vanishes when the blowing ash reincorporates. In the physical realm, Ash Spren appears a crack that grows on a surface or branches through the air. When they move, they seem to burn through material, but leave the surface behind unmarred. We had few opportunities to examine Ash Spren closely, and they behaved in a hostile manner in every encounter. Most of them I only saw in passing.
29. A cage without bars. I have begun searching for a pathway out of this conundrum by seeking the ideal person to act on my behalf. Someone who embodies both preservation and ruin. A sword, you might say, who can both protect and kill. Adolin glanced up as he heard the call from the watchpost at the front of the barge. Land sighted. Finally, he thought, giving Gallant a firm pat on the neck. The animal nickered in anticipation.
Trust me, he said to the Rashadium. I'm as happy to land as you are.
Adolin had always been fond of traveling, feeling the open breeze on your face, the welcoming sky overhead. Who knew what exotic tastes and fashions you'd find at your destination?
Taking a ship, though, was excruciating. No space to run, no good sparring grounds. A ship was a cage without bars. He left Gallant and rushed up to the barge's prow. A dark strip of obsidian broke the sea ahead, with quiet lights shimmering above. Not souls, but actual candles in the windows of small structures. In Shadesmore, Spryn could manifest the beads that represented the soul of a fire, and in so doing create flames that provided light, but very little heat. Others gathered at the sides of the barge, and Godecki joined Adolin on the small upper deck. The lanky edge dancer seemed as eager as Adolin to be off the boat. Adolin had seen Godecki pacing more than once these last few days. Unfortunately, the responsible side of Adolin, drilled into him over years with his father, made him call for caution. "We don't know the situation in this town yet," he said to the others. "Last time I was in Shadesmore, the first town we entered ended up being held by the Fused. We should send some of the Lightweavers in, wearing disguises, to scout."
"You will not find danger here,"
Wapom promised, rubbing his knuckles together in a curious gesture, making a sound like two rocks grinding.
"These are free lands. Neither Onrespren nor Fused control this outpost."
"Still," Adolin said, looking to the others, "humans, under the tarp until we've done some basic scouting." Grumbling, they gathered their horses and moved into the large room under the tarps. Shallan was resting here already. Most of them had opted to place their bedrolls here, where the tall boxes of cargo had been stacked to make various nooks and cubbies. Adolin nudged her. "Shallan, you all right?" The dark lump that was his wife stirred.
"Might have had a little too much to drink last night."
Adolin smiled. The trip had been genuinely relaxing, save for his worry about their destination. It had been good to spend time with Shallan, and he had enjoyed even the appearances of Vale and Radiant. The latter made an excellent sparring partner, and the former knew a seemingly infinite number of card games, some of which were good Vorin games, and others, well, they had too much randomness for propriety, but were more fun than Adolin had expected. It had culminated with Shallan pulling out an excellent Thalen Violet, Cadicillin vintage, last night. As usual, she'd had a few more cups than Adolin. Shallan had a strange relationship with drink, one that varied based on her persona. But since she could burn off the effects using Stormlight, she theoretically could never be drunk unless she wanted to be. It baffled him why she would sometimes go to sleep like she did, risking the morning hangover. "I want someone to scout the town before we go in," Adolin said. "You want me to send—"
"I'll go,"
she said, climbing out of her bedroll.
"Give me a few minutes."
True to her word, she was ready a short time later, wearing a light weaving that made her look like a cultivation spren. She took Vatha in a similar disguise, and the two of them disembarked with Wapom and his cousin to walk through the town. The rest of them waited under the tarp. Godecki fished in his pockets and brought out a few spheres. His personal money seemed to mostly have been chips, which had gone done by this point. They'd seen a high storm several times, storms manifested here as shimmering lights in the sky, but the spheres hadn't been recharged.
"Even the brome I brought is starting to fade," Godecki noted, holding up the amethyst to give light to the darkness under the tarp. "The larger gemstones we brought probably won't last until we reach the fortress, Bright Lord."
Adolin nodded. They'd gone over the Stormlight budget a dozen times leading up to leaving. No matter how they'd been able to spin it, there wasn't a way to reach lasting integrity with any Stormlight remaining. So the gifts they'd brought were things Syl said would be appreciated. Newly written books, puzzles made of iron that could engage the mind for hours, and some weapons. There was one way they might have brought Stormlight that lasted longer. The Thalens owned gemstones that were, because of their near-perfect structures, capable of retaining Stormlight over long time periods. The best of these had been used a year ago to capture one of the Unmade,
and Jasnah wanted the others for experiments. Jasnah had mentioned something else about these near-flawless gemstones that troubled her. She found it odd that the gemstones in circulation as spheres were always so flawed that they lost light quickly. She said that they should vary, and more perfect ones should be found on occasion. But that wasn't the case. Why was she concerned by that? He pondered the question as he waited for Shallan and tried to trace Jasnah's thoughts. What if someone had been in the know while everyone else thought gemstones were all basically the same? If you knew the supreme value of gemstones that could hold stormlight over long trips through Shadesmar, you could spend years gathering them. He frowned, considering it. Finally, he glanced at Gordeki, who was holding up one of his fading brooms. When you're free to go into the city, Adolin told him, take most of our remaining stormlight and do as we discussed. Trade it for supplies to use on the next leg of our trip. Then spend the remainder to load up the barge. Wapam's cousin would wait at the town to guard their supplies. Adolin's group only needed to carry enough to get to and from Lasting Integrity. Assuming everything went well with Shallan's investigation